Even people who feel confident and well-adjusted can be knocked off kilter by a group dynamic. Example, people in the workplace we don't get along with. We may not see eye to eye, but we do have to work and create together. Our guest this hour talks about using the wisdom of horses and their human handlers to make relations better. Linda Kohanov's book is The Five Roles of a Master Herder, subtitled A Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. Linda Kohanov is a big believer in the healing potential of working with horses. She set up a PonaQuest worldwide to explore that potential further, and she's the author of four previous books, including Way of the Horse and The Tao of Equus, Equus being the Latin name for today's horses. Linda Kohanov, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange. So I was a little surprised to find out that you are not the kind of person who's been around horses your entire life. This is more of an adult discovery.
Exactly. I wanted horses when I was younger, but my parents were afraid of them.
So
when I moved out to Tucson, Arizona, to work in public radio and be a music critic, actually, I was able to get my first horse, and I realized that my horse was challenging me in ways that I had never been challenged before. I had been program director of a radio station. I had had a number of positions running large music festivals, and my horse didn't respond to me recognizing that I had, you know, a degree or that I had a certain position. And that's what we face a lot of times when we're promoted to a managerial position or we're put in charge of a project. People don't necessarily follow you just because you have a title. And the horses were challenging me in that way.
So, you know, it always made sense to me that horses, I mean, they certainly have their own personalities, but, you know, they have really big brains in those heads, bigger than ours, I would think. And so so it seems to me they'd probably want to, you know, show who they are once in a while as well.
Yeah, they're massive animals, and they're very powerful. But the interesting thing about horses is that they're powerful and large, but they're not predators. And so they have this different psychology. And I learned a lot from them about how to use power in a non-predatory way and what that involved. And it really changed my life.
So in a sense, did you learn from horses how people respond to us? I mean, you gave a fairly direct example there in working as a manager in public radio.
Yes, actually, when I was working with my horses, I was learning how to be assertive without being aggressive. Because if you're aggressive with them, they can panic, and they're very dangerous when they panic. But you can't be a pushover either. You can't just sweet-talk them and pet them into doing what you want. You actually have to be powerful and centered, but not aggressive. And for many people, that's kind of a paradox. And so what I found was they were really tuning me to use power in a more effective way and to be able to connect with others. You know, a lot of us think of power and collaboration as opposites. But they taught me that I needed both. I needed to be powerful, but I needed to collaborate. I needed to engage. I needed to connect. And then I had a horse that was willing to follow me. And sometimes I might be willing to go with their ideas if they had a good idea. So I even learned a kind of consensual leadership with them.
The idea of power and collaboration as opposites is really an interesting one. And I would just ask, how ready do you think the world is for new ways of getting people to work together?
Well, I think we need it more than ever. We're at a real impasse because we have different conceptions of power and collaboration. We have, you know, more aggressive, competitive ways of engaging power. And then we also have a lot of people who are more interested in social services and taking care of others. And, you know, even in government right now, we see this sort of coming to grips with these two different concerns, and they shouldn't be opposites. When you see master herders in traditional pastoral cultures, and I mean cultures, these are cultures that move with large animals like horses or cattle without fences or without restraints. And so they actually need to nurture the herd and gain the trust of the herd, but they also have to be really powerful and stand up to raging adolescent stallions and help to socialize that amazing form of power that these large animals have without breaking the spirit of these animals.
So I want to be clear on the herding skills we're talking about here. Are we talking about the skills that the herders use on the animals? Are we talking about the skills that the herders use with each other? Or is there a bit of a mixture in there?
There's a definite mixture there. And what's interesting is that with these ancient nomadic herding cultures, the skills are more relevant than ever because we have more freedom than we've ever had. You know, the last 5,000 years of civilization has perfected a kind of dominant submission hierarchical paradigm. But now all the old fences are falling down, literally and figuratively. We live in an era of rapid change and unprecedented freedom. We have freedom to fly around the planet for business or pleasure, and freedom to work at home in lucrative and meaningful ways. And, you know, if you have a great idea, you can raise money on the internet, you can have supplies delivered to the door, you can start a multi-million dollar corporation in the corner of basement or garage like Steve Jobs did. And so as a result, people are more free, they have more choices now. And so if you work for a corporation and you are aware of this level of freedom and opportunity, it's hard to intimidate someone like that into submission, because they're going to quit and go somewhere else and start a company and become your competition. And so even though we see a tendency in government these days to go more toward a kind of dominant submission paradigm, or a kind of bullying and pushing through at times, in the corporate world and in the social services world and in nonprofits, people aren't going to be so easily intimidated, and you're going to lose your brightest staff members if you are using the old dominant submission intimidation forms of power.
The old Mr. Dithers Dagwood Bumstead way of dealing with things is not going to work in today's world. I hear you loud and clear. Linda Kahanov is the author of The Five Roles of a Master Herder. We'll talk more with her in just a moment. As we go to the break, let me let you know once again, we're planning a show on Planned Parenthood on Friday and are looking for input from you. So if you have a story about what Planned Parenthood means to you, from abortion to birth control or STD screening, we'd like to hear your story. Record it at our voicemail line at 541-552-6331. 541-552-6331. Back in a minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Linda Kahanov, who's a big believer in the healing potential of working with horses. She set up a foundation to explore that potential further. She's the author of 4 books, including Way of the Horse. Her latest is called The 5 Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. And we're going to learn a bit more about not just how the herders work with the animals, but how the herders work with each other. And you can join in, 800-838-3760, for questions or some stories to tell of collaboration or not. 800-838-3760 by phone and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the 5 roles: we have dominant, we have leader, we have nurturer, companion, that's one, sentinel, and predator. Do most people naturally gravitate to one or just a few of those, Linda?
Yeah, most people will gravitate toward one or two of these roles. Some people are naturally good at a role, and sometimes you're good at a role because you've been socially conditioned to be good at a role. So, you know, sometimes you have women, for instance, who grew up in the 1950s and 1960s. They were taught to be good at the nurturer companion role. But among some of those women would have been naturally inclined to be better at the dominant role. And so they may be acting out the dominant role in these instinctual ways because they never really learned how to harness that power properly. They were only taught to be nurturer companions. And so other people are phenomenal at the leader role. And one of the things that's really interesting is that among large groups of herbivores like horses and cattle, the leader animal and the dominant animal are often two different animals in a herd.
That's what I was going to ask about, whether those are separate entities, dominant and leader.
Yes, they are. They're separate. They actually have used different forms of power and influence. And if you're going to be a really great leader of free, empowered people or animals, you need to be more of what I would call a master herder, in the sense that a master herder is the master of 5 different roles that others often over-specialize in 1 or 2. And so to be really a great leader of animals and people that are free, empowered, have their own social lives, can move around, you need to recognize that the dominant role and the leader role are different, and that sometimes you need one or sometimes you need the other, and that you actually gain the trust of a group through engaging in the nurturer companion role. And then there's the sentinel role, which is where you watch group dynamics in relation to threats and opportunities on the horizon. And then you separate all 4 of those roles from the role of predator. and you use predatory power only to cull the herd to keep life in balance with available resources or for euthanasia purposes. And so really, you know, an animal like a horse will engage the dominant role to drive off predators and protect the herd. So you don't actually need predatory power for protection. You just need to be able to use the dominant role effectively.
To continue the metaphor a little further, though, would the predator role be used in a workplace, for example, by getting rid of people who are not helping the organization?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when you decide to fire somebody, or if you decide you have to engage in some layoffs because of a shift in the economy, that's the use of the predator role, if you're using it properly. To indiscriminately fire people without trying some other things first, that's an overuse of the predator role. Or to try to kill the competition, these kinds of things are an overuse of the predator role.
I wonder how situationally dependent these roles are. I mean, I can imagine that most people are going to respond to something in here, one of these five roles, when somebody's being the herd leader here or just trying to influence the herd. But does the response differ depending on the circumstances?
Yes, that's the point. The idea of the master herder is not that we're dealing with master and slave relationships. This is really the idea of having self-mastery and also mastery of five different roles, understanding situationally when and how to use each one to greatest effect for the good of the individual as well as the larger social system.
Now, you mentioned women in the 50s and 60s who might not tend to gravitate to dominant and leader roles. I'm curious to know what kind of gender split you see in people born more recently, if everybody seems equally adept at taking on any one of these five roles, or if there is still a bit of a gender imbalance with men tending to gravitate toward wanting to be the leader or be dominant.
I would say there's still a bit more of a gender imbalance, but much, much less than there was because these days, I mean, people talk a lot about how you have to work differently with the so-called millennials. In general, men and women who we would consider to be of the millennial generation are more empowered, and they're much less likely to put up with any kind of intimidation or dominant submission techniques. They're quick to quit, and their standards for working in a system like that are, you know, they just simply will not put up with what people were conditioned to put up with the previous 5,000 years.
Right. You differentiate between goal-oriented and relationship-oriented approaches, and would you say that either one is ascendant at the moment among employers?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of research in the importance of emotional and social intelligence, and so, you know, they showed that people with high emotional and social intelligence are four times more successful than people with just raw IQ and training. So, you know, the literature talks about the importance of relationship-oriented balance. But the way things are happening, it's like a lot of businesses haven't caught up with the idea of developing relationship skills and emotional and social intelligence skills. They're still relying on a lot of stressful, goal-oriented behavior, and you need it. You need a combination of both. We need a balance of both. You sometimes have people who are very relationship-oriented, especially in social service fields, and then sometimes they get promoted to a management position, and they're so oriented toward relationship that they can't focus on the goal. And when you're leading people or you're using the dominant role that more or less pushes them out of their comfort zone and gets them, you know, headed in the right direction, when you're doing that, you have to make people uncomfortable for a few minutes. So if your prime directive as a counselor or social service agency worker is to make people comfortable, you're going to be terrible as a manager because you're not going to be able to move forward and lead people through the discomfort of change. So you really need a combination of both.
Okay, so if your disposition then is to be among these roles, nurturer, companion, you do have to switch that off or at least put that aside in favor of another role where it's clear you're the boss.
Right, and you can actually use these roles as a kind of, crescendo. In music, a crescendo is where you gradually increase the volume consistently. And so you can start off by engaging with people at a nurturer companion level. Let's say you have an employee that's not working well. you can sit down with them and have a conversation and find out what's going on with them. What kind of additional training do they need? Is there something going on in their life or with their coworkers that's causing a disruption in their ability to perform? Do they need some conflict resolution skills? And then if that's not working, you might bring them to a place of taking on this sentinel perspective. In other words, showing how their behavior is affecting the entire group and affecting the company's ability to fulfill its mission. And if that's not working, then you might bring in the leader, which is more like giving them the skills, leading by example, drawing them forward, inspiring them to make the shifts that they need to make, and talking about how in the future they might be promoted if they can move through this difficulty. And if that's not happening, it's time to pull out the dominant. The dominant says, this behavior has got to stop. You need to move in this direction. I insist. And, you know, the dominant's last job is to tell the person who hasn't changed their behavior that the predator's coming in next if they don't see some improvement by this date. And then when the predator comes in, the predator is like, okay, we've given you these chances. I told you this was your last chance. And without apology, it's time for you to move on. You're clearly not a good fit for this organization.
All right. So I can see how we cycle through all the roles there and make it clear that that the boss is going to be a different complexion depending on the situation.
Right.
Linda Kahanov is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is called The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a revolutionary model for socially intelligent leadership. Those five roles are dominant, leader, nurturer, companion, that's one, sentinel, and predator. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Maybe you have some stories to share about ways in which you have had these roles used on you, or ways in which you have used these roles to help manage other people. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Trish in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. I was calling to thank Linda for the important work she's contributed to our field. And I actually employ a lot of her principles in the work that we do here in Ashland with our Writing Beyond program.
Mm-hmm.
A number of our volunteers have been really influenced by especially this latest book of Linda's. And although our program is initially focused on breast cancer survivors, our group events are for the public on Saturday afternoons, mm-hmm. mornings, and we actually employ some of these principles of allowing people to experience those different roles in the context of working with horses. And it's also a critical piece of what I teach in a course about how to take a good idea and turn it into a broad-based community-supported program. This whole idea of the different kinds of leadership that Linda was just explaining so clearly and so well. And so, Linda, I really appreciate all you have contributed to this whole movement in the direction of the horse-human connection, having a vital new role in the human journey.
Oh, and, thank you, Chris, and congratulations on the work you're doing. I'm glad to hear that there's a place in the area for people to go and experience this with horses. And as you know, you don't need horse experience to learn these particular skills with the horses, right?
Right. It's powerful for people, especially who don't have experience, but, you know, have a fascination perhaps with horses, just as you did, come into that realm of horses interacting with humans because they're so sensitive and they respond to our ways of communicating in ways that are very illuminating, and for us to learn to move between those roles, as you were talking about, is something that we all need. And I think especially in this climate that we're in right now, social climate and political climate, we're needing to learn ways of being more appropriately expressive. And so I'm thrilled at the opportunity that horses continue to give us for this kind of developing our own human selves.
Trish, the program is called Writing Beyond. Is that what you said?
Yeah, Writing Beyond. Writingbeyond.org is our website. People, if the listeners want to learn more about it. As I said, it's primarily for breast cancer survivors. Mm-hmm. The individual sessions are, but the group sessions are for the public. And they start in late May.
Okay.
And
Well, thanks for telling us about that. Yeah, Trish, thanks. Appreciate that. Linda, it sounds like you certainly are not, you're part of a movement here.
Yes, there's internationally, there's a rather large movement that is called various things, equine-facilitated learning, equine-facilitated human development, equine-assisted growth and learning, or is an organization. My organization, EponaQuest, specializes really in teaching advanced human development skills for people to excel in life. And then there are some therapeutic aspects, because one of the things I've found is that people who, let's say, they've been through some kind of severe trauma, rape or something like that, one of the things we found is that, you know, when it's time for them to reenter life and go back to work and be successful, they really need a model of becoming empowered and engaging with life that's not predatory, because they have been preyed upon by a member of their own species. So when people think about power as related to predatory metaphors, like lions and hyenas and wolves, you know, and it's a dog-eat-dog world out there kind of thing, it's very hard for a person who has experienced predatory actions from another member of their species to then accept power to move forward. And so we found that the horse, which is a non-predatory power animal, they are herbivores, they emphasize mutual aid over competition, and they take care of their vulnerable herd members rather than use vulnerabilities against them for personal gain. When people can really take on horsepower rather than, you know, predatory power, something shifts and they're able to move forward in life in a really exciting new way.
Linda Kahanoff, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her latest book about observing how horses react to human direction and how humans react to human direction is called The Five Roles of a Master Herder. There's an illuminating event here in the book that involved an injured horse, a dog, and a herd of cattle. Can you tell us that story?
Well, this is where I first began to understand what was really going on. We had this impression that, you know, horses are prey animals. They can be preyed upon in nature, and they certainly don't eat others. They eat grass. But we often then assume that they act like victims in all situations. So I was out walking with my horse, Rasa, who had an injured stifle, which is like the knee in humans, so she couldn't really be ridden. So I would go on these long trail walks with her because we were really engaged and very close. And I would take my dog with me, who was actually pretty aggressive. Her name was Nala. And we came across some cattle that were roaming free, as they do in Arizona. And these cattle had rather large horns, and they were coming right at us in this rather aggressive way. And I was thinking, wow, you know, I don't really have a whip with me. I'm not on horseback. I wonder how I'm going to handle this situation. And I thought maybe my dog would step forward and protect me, because she was always really aggressive with other animals. And what happened instead was that the dog took one look at this group of steers with these massive horns, and she ran over and huddled against my legs. And the horse, who I assumed was going to turn and run home, actually ran in front of the dog and me and herded these cattle away from us in this rather aggressive, dominant manner. But it really wasn't aggression. It was simply assertiveness, because the minute the cattle backed off, the horse calmed down and just stood between the cattle and the dog and me. And I was like, wow, that turns all my notions about, you know, predators being king of the jungle and horses being prey animals and quivering, gutless victims. It turned it all upside down. And so I began to research nature in a different way and found that, you know, it's really not particularly accurate to look at our large herbivores like horses and cattle and zebras as purely prey animals. They are non-predatory power animals. They can stand up and they can protect us.
So the horse, it seems like, acted dominant at first and then stood there as a sentinel.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was quite amazing to see that in action. And that particular horse started me on the road to create this work for people, actually, because she had been injured and couldn't be ridden. Mm-hmm. And I found that she had this marvelous ability to interact with people, and over time, she became one of my primary teachers in this field, and she's since passed away, but I have her sons and even her granddaughter now. So we're doing work out here in Arizona with the sons and granddaughter of Rasa.
You spent about 20 years researching what you'd seen that day. I mean, did you really have to wait for science to catch up to you, Linda?
Absolutely. There's a whole lot more science now that tells us, and I share it in the book. Even in the book, there's even some of the latest research on the human-animal bond that really shows that there's a lot of evidence that animals reached out to us rather than the other way around, and that mm-hmm. formed initially mutually beneficial partnerships.
We had the food.
Right.
It's probably got a lot to do with it. We'll talk more about how we deal with each other and how we deal with other animals as well. The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership, is the latest book by Linda Kahanov, who is big about learning from horses and how they respond to pressure and lack thereof. We'll come back and talk more with Linda and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Linda Kahanov, who has been working with horses and people, exploring the healing potential of horses for a long time now. She's written a number of books. Her latest is called The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. It observes how people in herding societies dealt with their animals and with each other and how that is helpful in situations where we have to work with other people today. Join us on the exchange. You might have a story to tell about running up against a person who was handling you in ways you didn't like, or ways in which you had to learn how to deal with other people in ways that they were better responsive to. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. A couple of phrases really stand out in the book, and one of them is that you say it takes a tough person to lead a caring organization. Can you explain that one?
Yes. One of the big paradoxes when I was working in nonprofits and social service organizations was that when people who were in these caring fields, they would tend to be really naturally good at what we call the nurturer companion role. And then when they would be promoted to a managerial position and had to make some tough decisions or get people moving in uncomfortable directions, they needed to balance that caring orientation with a really balanced use of power. Because anytime you lead people out of their comfort zone, you're going to get some resistance. Because people like to be comfortable, so you have to push them a little bit at times. Or you might have to lead them and draw them with inspiration. And both the leader role that leads and draws toward a goal that has a level of energy that's invigorating and inspirational, and the dominant role, which comes back around behind and pushes the resistant individuals to head in that direction. Both of those roles involve a little bit of toughness at times, and it involves a little bit of moving people beyond comfort. And so this is why a lot of caring organizations will come to a kind of an impasse when it's time to make some changes. And that's when you need somebody who's has a compassionate use of power, who can be tough when needed, but with an underlying caring, connecting orientation is what that means.
Is there any kind of an assessment in the book or something along those lines that allows us to figure out for ourselves which ones we naturally are?
Yes, yes. In the book, there's a professional assessment, and this is for you to take. And it's important to take it with a particular professional position in mind. So if, let's say, you work for a bank and you also are on the board of a nonprofit, you need to take the professional assessment for each situation, because in different situations and according to your job description, you might be caused to overemphasize certain roles in one setting and overemphasize certain roles in another setting. And when you overemphasize roles, each role has a kind of shadow side with some dysfunctional behavior that comes out. So when you overemphasize the dominant role, you can be overly intimidating and you can alienate people. And there's all these little crazy, seemingly illogical things that people who overemphasize the dominant role will do. But they make a lot of sense when you recognize the way that immature dominant animals act in a herd. If you ever emphasize the leader role, you can get too far in front of people, and you can also seem a little aloof and self-absorbed because you're focusing on a lofty goal and ignoring everyone behind you. So you have to be careful not to overemphasize that role. When you overemphasize the nurturer companion role, you will often engage in passive-aggressive power plays, and you can be really toxic to an organization if you overemphasize that role. So those are some of the examples.
In particular, to try to differentiate between dominant and leader, and I think I got a whiff of it just now. I mean, the dominant is more, it sounds like more other-directed behavior. I am telling you what to do, where a leader is, I'm going to do this and you're going to follow me.
Yes, it has a lot to do with that. And you'll see that, there are naturally dominant individuals. It seems like some people and animals have a certain kind of orientation or gift for this role. And when it's used in a mature way in balance with the other roles, it's highly effective. But an immature dominant will use intimidation as a management tool. They walk into a room and they expect people to yield to them. And
Alec Baldwin and Glengarry Glen Ross.
Exactly. That's a great example of an overly dominant. That's a predatory dominant.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great example of watching him. He's a predatory dominant. When you combine those two roles, and most dictators will combine those two roles at the exclusion of the other roles. And those people are extremely dangerous and destructive. And I just watched Glengarry Glen Ross. It's so funny that you mentioned that last week.
Uh-huh.
And I just realized when you really look at that, you see what effect that kind of a quote-unquote leader has on others, because the entire organization degrades and they start engaging not just in unethical behavior but in actual illegal behavior out of desperation. So,
well, then that brings us to the question then about there are organizations that think that predatory behavior is a good thing. I mean, that the heightened competition and the kill or be killed environment gives the best results. I mean, are there situations where you think that might actually be true, or are you more likely to think they need to be a little more humanistic?
Well, I think that where that mentality becomes most dangerous is when you use this kill or be killed attitude among members of your own team. And so really what you need to do is run your own team or your own business through non-predatory power, and then save the predatory power. If you want to be highly competitive and kill the competition, save that for the competition. Don't do that to your own people, because it destroys trust and it makes people work against each other on a team. But increasingly, as it turns out, this kill or be killed competitive mentality is less effective. I was at a Paris MBA program presenting this model, and the person who founded this, they're in high-tech industries, and he said that doesn't even work anymore, because a lot of startup companies these days, you want to be sold. You want someone to buy you out. And if you engage in a kill or be killed mentality with your competition, they're likely to hold a grudge, and then you have less people to accept your product when you're ready to sell it. So, it's this kill or be killed mentality is not relevant, and it doesn't really work that well in nature either. There's studies that show that mutual aid is as much or more of a factor in the success of a species than competition for limited resources mentality.
Do you do a fair amount of speaking and traveling and giving something along the lines of seminars, I gather, but do you get corporate clients? I mean, are they hiring you to put some of this very wisdom to work on what they're doing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, I was in Portland, Oregon a few years back at Nike with their systems innovation department teaching this model. I'm going to go up and teach this model to Kaiser next week.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked with a major player in the missile building industry. I'm not allowed to say who it is. I'm trying to get permission eventually to say who it is, but for the past, since 2007, I've worked for a major missile building company.
Mm-hmm.
To teach their engineers how to become leaders to develop these skills.
The reason I ask the question is because when you mention how things are a little different in the high-tech field, I just wonder if structures in the workplace are changing so fast that you're getting surprised at times by how people relate to one another and trying to find the appropriate roles on this list.
Well, that's the beauty of this model, is if you can teach people when and how to use all five roles, and you teach everybody on a team to use all five roles, then when the market changes suddenly, people have the ability to make adjustments. And so it's significant that this model of the master herder comes from nomadic pastoral cultures, cultures that moved across vast distances with large, empowered animals, without fences and without restraints. And so they had to have all five of these roles to work with these animals and these people through changing climates, through changing economic situations. And this is what we face now. You know, we really need to bring the brilliance of the technological innovations that could only have been developed in a sedentary city-based culture. And we need now to combine that with the relationship and leadership genius of our nomadic cousins. We need both now more than ever.
And again, the roles are dominant, leader, nurturer, companion, that is one title, nurturer, companion, sentinel, and predator. And it seems like people are going to have natural ways of falling in within those roles, within any herd, for lack of a better term. But if you have somebody who wants to be sentinel all the time and don't particularly want to be a leader or step up or don't want to be the nurturer companion role, how do you convince them to get outside of their comfort zone just enough to be able to be more valuable to a group?
I think the main reason is to look at the dysfunctions that arise when you overemphasize a role and see how incredibly inefficient and dysfunctional you are if you hang on to one role. And, there's every single one of the roles, including the sentinel. If you overemphasize the sentinel role, there are some problems there. And so, and for people to learn that, you know, you don't have to consider yourself to be a dominant, to use the dominant role sparingly for specific reasons. You don't have to consider yourself to be a nurturer companion, as well as to say, oh, I'm going to use the nurturer companion role to connect and build trust on my team and to make sure everybody has the skill sets and support that they need to do their job. You know, you don't have to say, oh, I'm going to be a mothering figure to my team. No, the nurturer companion role is really about making connections, recognizing what people need to do their job, and having them trust you enough to be able to come and tell you when they need something rather than hide this and engage in greater dysfunction as a result.
And it would seem to me that being a good listener is probably a key to all this, is knowing which role is required at that moment.
Yes, yes.
So there's a name in here. We mentioned research, and this goes back a bit in time to long before what we're talking about here, but Peter Kropotkin, an interesting character. What did he contribute to this thinking?
Well, he was a Russian prince who lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s, and he had a lot of time and money on his hands. This was pre-Russian Revolution. And he really got excited about Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection, and he decided that he was going to make his mark in the world by commandeering a group of 50 horses and 10 Cossacks and going out across the Siberian outback and collecting anecdotes in nature to prove Darwin's theories. And so he was out there, and he came back, and he said, you know what, the way that Darwin's theories is currently being overemphasized such that we're saying that, you know, this is a dog-eat-dog world, and competition for limited resources is what we're facing, and, you know, even social Darwinism being used by politicians and kings and businesses at that time to use the theory of evolution to justify highly predatory business and political practices. Kropotkin came back and said, this is not actually the way that nature is working. He said that mutual aid is more of a factor in the success of certain species than competition for limited resources. And so he ended up writing a series of essays and then eventually collecting them into a book called Mutual Aid, A Factor of Evolution. And this was published in around 1902, and you can get it now. You can get the English translation of it off of Amazon. And he really shows you all the examples in nature of mutual aid being a significant factor in the survival and success of different species.
You know, I wondered as I was reading this book, Five Roles of a Master Herder, when you're dealing with humans and animals together, particularly with horses, do you wonder sometimes, Linda, as you observe, who's herding whom?
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, horses don't believe that you're in charge just because you walk around on two legs and bought yourself a fancy new pair of cowboy boots. And a lot of times I see horses herding people around. And, you know, if the horse has a good idea and he's respectful and you want to, you know, let him take the leadership role now and then, that's fine. But a lot of people don't know how to direct a horse because you have to use actual power and focus. You can't sweet talk a horse into doing what you ask. And again, you can hold up 15 different degrees and you can, you know, show the horse your stock portfolio, and they're not going to defer to you because you have more money and more degrees than they do. They're actually only going to work for you when you have real, authentic presence and power in the moment.
Which is expressed in a number of different ways. And as we talked about, the five roles of a master herder are dominant, leader, nurturer, companion, sentinel, and predator, and they'll all get uses at different times, some of them sparingly, as Linda Kahanoff points out in her book, The Five Roles of a Master Herder, a Revolutionary Model for Socially Intelligent Leadership. Linda, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It was a pleasure.
All right, take care.